Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you're bothered by mosquitoes, bats are your friend. Nature's only flying mammal is on the case, eating their body weight in insects every night. But just as the number of mosquito-borne diseases appears to be on the rise, the number of bats is declining. For about two decades, a fast-spreading fungus, white nose syndrome, has been decimating the bat population here. Species like the tricolored bat, once common in the Piedmont, are edging closer to extinction. Don't believe me? In 2011, it was estimated there were about 5,000 of them in our area. Now, that number is 500 for the entire state. But there are efforts being undertaken to reverse that trend, and we're going to hear about them and the role bats play in our ecosystem and about the white nose syndrome that has been attacking bats. Catherine Etchison is a wildlife diversity biologist at the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. She won the Golden Bat Award, which we'll talk about, in 2020. Chris Shomo is a wildlife specialist and wildlife damage control agent for A1 Wildlife Control, and Jacob Schmidt is a rising high school sophomore at Northwest Cabarrus High School who, as part of his Eagle Scout project, has put up bat boxes in the local area. And we'll find out what bat boxes are and whether or not you should be involved in doing that as well. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. So, Catherine, I'm going to start with you because I must ask first, what is the Golden Bat Award? I actually went to Google and looked it up, and it was all about baseball. So I'm sure that's not what we're talking about.
Yeah, not baseball. So we have a group here in North Carolina called the North Carolina Bat Working Group. And it's a group of professionals in the state and those that are outside of the state, but they do work in North Carolina, some part of their work. And all of us work with bats or are bat enthusiasts. And so we meet annually. We have some different projects that we work on collaboratively. And every year, a member of the group is nominated for the Golden Bat Award. And it's something that we all sort of hope for at some point in our career. And yeah, I was honored with that back in 2020, as you said. And so we have a little trophy that is a bat and it's sort of golden-esque. It's not actually made of gold because we're a bunch of bat biologists. And, you know, that's not something that we can muster up the funds for. But we trade it around, whoever's turn it is to get the trophy. You can have it in your office for a year.
It's your Oscar. Most people think of bats as pests at best, dangerous at worst. They have fears of bats spreading disease. They have fears of being attacked by bats, of getting them caught in their hair if they get too close. And I'm going to bet that you have a different point of view altogether on bats. Would that be accurate?
That is accurate, yes.
And when did that point of view emerge in you?
I first started working with bats in 2010. And so that's when it was kind of born out of, you know, my curiosity and interest of bats was born out of my first field job with bats back then. The first bat I caught, I was just hooked. I've just wanted to work with bats ever since.
And I'm curious about Jacob too, because you're involved in this. You chose to work with bat boxes, build bat boxes as your Eagle Scout project. You're a rising sophomore, so you're young. When did bats become interesting to you?
Well, I was first introduced to them by Mr. George Berger. He's the head of the Concord Parks and Recreation Department. When he was giving me suggestions for my Eagle project, and I was just really interested in them. I thought their behavior was extraordinary, just learning about all the different behaviors of bats, like echolocation. And I just felt there was a great need to serve them in my community because of how much they happen to be in decline.
And I want to talk to Catherine about how you view them, because you obviously see them through a different lens than most people. But let me bring Chris into this conversation for just a moment as well, because Chris, as I understand it, you're the guy I call if I have a bat problem.
Yeah, that's definitely the truth. I've been doing this for about 10 years here now.
But you're involved in ethical bat removal, and we'll talk about why there is such a thing as ethical bat removal as we go through the program. But how do you view these creatures?
Well, I've always been interested in bats since a young age. One reason, probably, I grew up in comic book shops. My whole family ran bookstores and comic stores, and so Batman was definitely a big part of my childhood. And when I ended up moving to Charlotte about 10 years ago, I got a job offer after having some roofing and construction experience. They wanted some guys that can get on ladders and get on rooftops and all that. And that's just something that as I've learned more and more about it, it's just become more and more interesting to me, and I'm always searching out more education on the subject.
So, Catherine, what should we know about bats that perhaps we don't know and that perhaps would change our minds about them if we have a negative view of them or if we're afraid of them?
Well, like you said at the top of the show, our bats here in North Carolina, they did eat insects, including mosquitoes. And so even if you don't really like bats, I think we can all sort of get behind the idea that they're eating mosquitoes, they're eating other insects that serve as pests, both for the crops that the food that we eat, and also our forests. So they help keep our crops healthier, our forests healthier, and us healthier by way of eating, mosquitoes and other insects that bother us. So I think we can all find that a little beneficial.
So, although our bats are not particularly tiny, there's one bat that I read about yesterday that will fit nicely on your little finger. But there's another bat that I read about yesterday that has a 6 foot wingspan. I don't want to meet him. But these bats are, I'm told, are highly social animals. That's why they roost together. And when they roost together, they're actually sharing information about food sources and helping to maintain each other's body temperature. How do they share information about food sources?
Yeah, a lot of our bats are highly social, as you say, and they roost in groups that we call colonies. And so a lot of times it's even the females that will group up together and roost in these colonies. Males will do it a little bit as well, but in smaller groups oftentimes. Usually the big groups are females. So yeah, they have lots of important information to share. If they find a really good area that has a whole lot of insects, they're going to share that information with one another. They kind of help each other survive. They help heat each other up when it's cold, and they help protect each other from predators by grouping up together and signaling when there's, a predator like a snake coming into the
Right.
roost or something like that. So
Well,
they're very social, and it helps protect them.
with bees, we know that bees have these dances that they do for other members of their colony to tell them where you can find pollen. We don't understand it, but the bees obviously do. So how do the bats communicate that information?
They oftentimes, if you find a big bat roost, you can hear them. They're just in there squeaking away at each other. And so I would imagine it's through some of these little audible chirps and clicks and squeaks that they make, and that's how they're getting their point across. But there's a whole lot we still don't really understand well about bats. And so yeah, there's a lot that we don't really know exactly how they do some of what they do.
So you can hear those squeaks and clicks that you alluded to a moment ago, but there's also another language that they speak while they're on the hunt that we really cannot hear. It's above the range of human hearing, but we have developed machines that can record and lower the pitch, I guess, to the point where we can hear it. And they use it as a kind of what? Sonar to navigate the world, echolocation. This is what it sounds like when you put it through all the magic boxes that allow us to hear it. So those are the sounds being the echolocation sounds being produced by a little brown bat, which is a bat that's common in our area. Can you explain what we just heard and how it's used?
Yeah, so bats, I would say one thing for people to just know is they're not blind. Sometimes people think bats are actually blind. They can see as well as we can see, but since they're nocturnal and they've got to navigate a world in darkness, they have developed this sense of echolocation, which gives them a lot more information about their surroundings than their eyesight will. And so as they're flying through the air at night, they're out there doing two things. They are looking for insects, but they're also sending out echolocation calls to actually navigate and not run into things, buildings and trees and that kind of thing. So they're sending out these calls, these little clicks that are above our hearing range, as you mentioned, we can't hear them, to get listen for that echo and get that feedback about how close certain things are to them. And so a lot of times what we say that they're doing when they're just broadly kind of listening is they're sending out search phase calls. And those are usually in search of prey. And as they get closer to that prey item, they'll send out really rapid calls because they need a lot of echoes coming back really quickly because they're almost to that insect. And so we didn't hear that in that particular call. We heard a search phase call, but if it had been really close to an object, we would have heard just a rapid series of clicks.
And I know that there are some biologists who have actually developed the ability to not only read these things to a certain degree, but understand which species of bats produce them just by looking at the waveform on a piece of paper. I had a question and it's gone, and it's an important question. It's about, oh, how we discovered this. If we can't hear it, how did we discover they were making these sounds?
Yeah, that, and I think acoustic technology for lots of different taxonomic groups, not just bats, has been around for probably the last 40-ish years. And so there are a lot of different scientists out there trying different methods to see how can we study these animals, especially the ones like bats who are really cryptic, really kind of secretive, hard to find. They roost in places that are really tight and really dark. So we needed some other way to keep track of them. And so yeah, this acoustic technology has been around for a while and came out of that effort to learn more about these bats, but it's really gotten more sophisticated probably in the last 15 or so years. We keep getting new bat detectors on the market that can do more and more things and help us better understand which species are out there. So it's a really exciting time to be a bat biologist because we have more tools at our disposal.
But it's not an exciting time to be a bat, particularly in North America, because as we mentioned at the very beginning, they are being impacted by something called white nose syndrome, which we're going to talk about in the next segment. But first, I wanted to ask how we know the bat population is actually declining. And then I found that we know because people like you go out into the field and you conduct bat sensi or censuses, if that's the right word. How do you do that? How do you count the bat population?
It's tough because, like I said, bats are really secretive, and so it's hard to figure out all the places that they are. But once you find them, that's something to work off of because they're really faithful to the places that they either hibernate or roost in the summertime. And so if you go back in repeated years, you're able to actually count bats at whatever site that you found them at. And you can see, you know, are the numbers, the counts, are they going up? Are they going down? Are they staying about the same? And if you have enough sites across the state, you're able to interpret these broad population trends to understand how a species is doing across our state or across a particular region of our state. So one thing that is really informative for us is we, in the wintertime, we do what we call hibernacula surveys. And hibernaculum is just a place where an animal hibernates for bats. That tends to be in caves and underground mines. And so we go in there in the wintertime, and we just count all the bats. And we go every year, and that helps us understand how they're doing.
Catherine Etchison is not batty, but she's involved with bats, and we'll come right back and talk with her more about it in a moment.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about bats today. They're in decline across North America, primarily because of something called white nose syndrome, which we're going to be talking about in this segment. And the bat populations have been grossly affected by this. And there are ripples in the ecosystem as a result of that. And we're talking about it with Catherine Etchison. She's a wildlife diversity biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Also with us, Chris Shoma. We'll be talking to him about what to do if you have a bat problem in your house or outer building or something that you'd like to responsibly take care of. He's a wildlife specialist with wildlife and a wildlife damage control agent with A1 Wildlife Control. And Jacob Schmidt is a rising high school sophomore whose project for his Eagle Scout badge, one of his Eagle Scout badges, deals with bat boxes. And we'll find out what they are and why you should build one or have one or two or three or more in your vicinity. Catherine, because bats are endangered and also federally protected, that's why they're federally protected, because they are endangered. What does that mean for the bats, for the people who might be concerned about bats flying around their property? And for those who have bats, who have made nests in their homes, what does that mean for them that they are federally protected?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So we have 17 bat species in North Carolina, and four of those are federally protected. They're listed as endangered. And then one additional one, the tricolored bat, is proposed to be listed as federally endangered. But that final listing determination is not out just yet. So we've got, you know, four to five, if you think about the tricolored, out of the 17 that are listed as federally endangered. But bats are really hard to identify and tell apart from one another. So we have a blanket protection over our bats in North Carolina so that we make sure that we are not harming a potentially endangered species when we're trying to remove bats from a building or a structure that they've roosted in.
For people who don't understand this whole idea of protecting species, and there are a lot of people who just don't understand it. I know there was the snail darter is the famous one that comes out of the 80s, where people were upset because they wouldn't build highway overpasses in certain areas of creeks and streams because they would harm the snail darter population. Explain to me the function of what a bat does within our ecosystem. Why are they important?
Yeah, so worldwide can play a lot of different ecosystem roles or do different ecosystem services. They can act as pollinators. Some of our bats are carnivorous, and so that's their role in the ecosystem. But here in North Carolina, all of our bats eat insects, and they eat a ton of insects. You mentioned earlier, bats can eat up to their body weight in a single night. So they're actually doing a huge service by controlling our insect populations. And they're the only, well, I should say they're the primary nighttime predator of insects. So those insects that are out at night are really being controlled by our bat population. So that's their really significant contribution into our ecosystem here in North Carolina.
And according to your organization, the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, bats represent one quarter of all mammal species worldwide. That's amazing. That's a lot of bats. even though they can be helpful and we need them for the ecosystem and for all the reasons that you just mentioned, you also say never touch a bat. If you see a bat, if it's on the ground, don't pick it up with your hands. If they're not dangerous, why not?
Yeah, so bats, like other mammals, can carry rabies, and rabies is fatal. So we always want to take any rabies exposure or potential exposure really seriously. Oftentimes, if people are bitten by a bat, it's going to happen because you picked up a bat without gloved hands, and that bat was defending itself. It's scared. We're so much bigger than a bat, so it thinks, you know, potentially we're going to eat it. And its response is to bite because it wants to flee and get away from you. And that little bite is really kind of like a paper cut. It's pretty insignificant compared to most animal bites. You know, if a raccoon bit you, it'd be a different story most of the time. So people can kind of just shake it off as nothing and not seek medical treatment. And that can lead to rabies, and which is fatal. So we always want to make sure that people are just taking the right precautions and staying safe.
And if you do encounter a bat and you do get bitten in some way, say you should, even though not all bats are rabid or carry rabies, you should get medical attention right away. I'm just curious, Chris, because you go into situations where you perhaps are meeting more than one bat at a time, and have to remove them. And we'll talk about how you do that in a second, but how do you protect yourself?
So a lot of times when I'm just doing an inspection and determining if someone has bats or maybe they already know they do and I'm just kind of checking it out, I don't really need too much protection because I'm just kind of taking a look, seeing about how many there are, how much cleanup there might need to be from their feces and things like that, and looking around the house to see what type of stuff I'm going to need to seal up to keep them from returning. So I don't always need protective gear right away, but then at the end of the job, when I have guys coming in to do the cleanup and all that after the bats are all out, they're definitely going to need to wear some respirators, gloves, sometimes long sleeve shirts and long pants just to avoid secondary insects like bat mites and silverfish and other bugs that do like to feed in on and are attracted to their feces and the bacteria with their feces and their urine attracts that stuff. So definitely, if I was going to be handling a bat, wearing, protective gloves and things of that sort. But most of the time, we're never actually picking one up or anything like that, except in the rare cases where somebody has one, maybe just in their actual living space, as opposed to roosting in their attic or in a wall or behind their siding.
And we're going to talk about where they where these bats find make their way into most homes and how you find them and how you remove them a little while from now. I want to talk about white nose syndrome. This is the culprit that seems to be the most dangerous thing in for bats in North America and certainly in our region because they have been grossly affected by this. What is the is that the primary threat? White nose syndrome, Catherine?
It is, yes, for our
This
bats
is
here
that.
it is.
This is a fungus that actually turns the non-furry part of the bat, their nose, perhaps parts of their wing membranes, white. What's happening here?
Yeah, you're right. So this disease is caused by a fungus or a fungal pathogen. And it does, it grows on the portions of the body that are unfurred. So the face, the wing membrane, the tail membrane. And really things we know about this disease and have learned in the past 20 years is that it is native to Europe and was inadvertently brought over to New York State, just totally an accident. And we've had it here in North Carolina since 2011, and it's spread to most of our continental US states. This fungus, it grows in consistently cold, dark, and humid conditions. So if you think about the conditions in a cave or an underground mine, that's the perfect place for this fungus to grow. And the real crux of this whole thing is that when bats hibernate, they go into these places, into caves and into mines, and they get their body temperatures to within 1 degree of that ambient temperature in the space. And that allows the fungus to grow on their skin. If they weren't hibernating, their bodies would be too warm for the fungus to grow on them. And
And what is
basically,
it?
what happens? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, what does this fungus do to them?
Yeah. So what happens is it grows on them while they're hibernating, and it really irritates their skin. So they wake up out of hibernation to groom and clean themselves off. And if they could do that all winter with no consequences, they should be fine. But the problem is they have just enough fat reserves to last the winter. Every time they wake up, they burn through a portion of those fat reserves, and oftentimes they starve before spring has arrived and insects are plentiful and they can come out of hibernation.
And we found, I'm going to come to you, Chris, but we found that maybe human beings played a role in helping to spread this fungus because people who like to explore caves can go in and pick up some spores of this fungus on their clothing and then decide, well, let's go explore another cave and go into that cave and inadvertently take those spores with them and spread the infection. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a question for Catherine. With hibernation, it's my understanding that sometimes the bats are migrating and sometimes they're hibernating. Is that just how fast did it get cold this year? you know, is it more like to the, where they're roosting at, if it leads itself to more cold weather or hot weather? Because I do get a lot of, you know, jobs even in the winter where I've discovered a colony that's basically hibernating. And I do know that sometimes they're migrating because I have other houses where I go and it's pretty obvious they've been there all summer and now have moved on because it's cold.
Yeah, it's typically by species. Like certain species are migratory and they will leave an area for the winter, and certain species hibernate underground and go into caves and mines. The one that kind of straddles the line, and probably a species you deal with a lot, is the big brown bat. Yes. So sometimes we find them in caves and mines, and sometimes they'll overwinter in buildings. And so I'm sure you run into that. And just kind of going back to what Mike said about the spread, is primarily bats are actually spreading this disease themselves, although humans can spread it. And so we follow rigorous decontamination protocols to prevent spreading it. But the bats do a really good job of it themselves, unfortunately.
So bats, Chris, like to be in caves, but clearly they also like to find spaces within in homes and trees and other things. But homes are the problem that you have to deal with. Even though they're effective in mosquito control and controlling other insects, you don't want these creatures in your house. So when they do get in, what have homeowners not done that allowed that to happen?
So mostly it normally has very little to do with the homeowner and more to do with the home builder or people who have come subsequently to do roof on the work or exterior homework, you know, on the soffitting or the eaves of the home. One thing is, I'm from Michigan originally. In the north, the building codes are a little more strict because of the cold weather. So there's certain gaps and openings that when you're building a house under building code have to be sealed different ways. And down here in the south, where it's warmer most of the year, we don't get a lot of snow and ice. So the building codes are a little more relaxed on some of these things. And so when people are putting a new roof on your home or just building the home from scratch, there may be some areas where they aren't putting in some seals and things just because they're not really worried about water or snow or ice, and they're not really thinking animal-centrically when they're building these homes. So unfortunately, you know, I have everything from a house that's 100 years old that has an issue to one that was built just a year ago. And, you know, anywhere from a $100,000 building to something that costs millions, and all can have the same issues.
So what are the signs, aside from maybe seeing bats flying around at dusk around your house, what are the signs that you might have an infestation?
So, yeah, obviously, like you said, flying around the house at night, or you see them coming out of the eaves of your home, or one of the more common areas for them to infest is what we would call a louver or a gable vent on your home. Could be a triangle shape, a circle shape, a square shape, a rectangle. And the thing about those designs is it's almost built like you would build a bat home. It's angled pieces of wood that are blocking the sun from hitting their eyes, but it also gives them a screen that they can hang on to very easily and congregate. And so they're very attracted to those areas. Those tend to be the first areas in homes, and you'll start to see a lot of droppings piling up either in your driveway or actually sticking to the front of your home below those areas. Or maybe you actually had one enter your living space through a gap or an opening in your ceiling or underneath an attic door. That's pretty common as well. And then a lot of times it's a neighbor. Your neighbor's in their room and they're looking over at your house and they can see something you can't see from their perspective. And they're seeing the bats flying in and out or the feces piling up as well. That's usually the indication. A lot of times other services like heating and cooling or plumbing are doing their job in an attic, and they might notice something and bring it to the homeowner's attention as well.
So Jacob, it would seem to me that if you don't want these bats in your house, you wouldn't want them anywhere around your house, but evidently that is not the case, and you've been involved in providing hospitable shelter, let's put it that way, for these bats as part of your Eagle Scout project. You build or took upon yourself to build bat boxes. So before we talk about why, first tell me what a bat box is.
So a bat box, it is a structure that's used to house bats and excuse me. But yeah, it's a way to protect them from predators, and a more safe location in the ecosystem for them to
Would it
stay.
be accurate to say that a bat box is essentially a birdhouse for bats?
Basically, yeah, that's a great description, really.
But they're different in terms of size, I would think, in terms of size, even in color and construction. What about construction materials? How complicated is this to build one of these things?
It was pretty difficult when I did it. It's heavily involved, and there's many different parts that make the structure unique for the bat box.
So what has to happen for it to be hospitable and inviting for a bat?
Right. For the box itself, you're gonna have grooves lined in the backboard that the bats can hang onto, and they can climb up into the box itself. You're gonna want to have an angled roof. And for the placement of them, you're typically gonna want them away from too much vegetation and trees, so predators can't easily get to them. And one thing is keeping it facing east and west. Like if you have like for my bat box design, we had a post and two bat boxes on either end, and so we had it facing east and west, so there was constant direct sunlight on them, and it would be hotter on one side and cooler on the other, in case one gets too hot, they can move to the back one. And you also want.
And I read yesterday that depending upon where you are in the country, if you want to put one of these bat boxes, that depends on what color you paint these bat boxes, because you don't want a dark bat box in the south because it will absorb the heat of the sun and possibly kill the bat. You'd want it
Oh
to
yeah.
be a lighter color. Is that correct?
Yes, we. I had mine as a light gray color.
So how many bats on average live in these bat boxes that you build?
Around 50. Both of them. That's going to be pretty much 100. So I made two bat box posts. One in the Hector Henry Greenway and at Dorton Park. And in total, they should be around 200 bats that we should be able to house in these.
Yikes, that's a lot of bats. I want to come back and talk about that, particularly if people want to do this in their yards. We'll do that when we come back and talk a little bit more about the ecology of bats and how you ethically remove them if you need to from spaces in your home. We'll do that shortly with Jacob Schmidt, who's an Eagle Scout, Chris Shomo, wildlife control expert, and Catherine Etchison, wildlife biologist.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
Yes, we're talking about bats this morning on Charlotte Talks, and that is, in fact, the original Batman theme from television fame. We're talking about bats with with Catherine Etchison, wildlife diversity biologist in North Carolina, with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. I played that for Chris because that's how he got interested in bats through Batman comics. Chris Shomo's with us, wildlife specialist and wildlife damage control agent with A1 Wildlife Control, and Jacob Schmidt, who took it upon himself as a rising sophomore at help me out here, Chris. Jacob, rising sophomore at
Northwest.
Northwest Cabarrus High School. I had it wrong on my little piece of paper here. As part of his Eagle Scout project to build bat boxes. You just told me that you built what, two bat boxes, and they're in parks. And you have hundreds of bats living in these bat boxes. How big are these boxes?
So in total, I have four bat boxes at the two
Okay.
locations. I have not seen any yet, and I think that's because I was a little late in building them in the season, bat season, because I think they've already gone through their mating season. But it could take up for it could take up to a year before we actually start seeing some in there when next season comes around, which is typically from March to May.
But they
And
can,
so,
but those boxes can accommodate hundreds of bats per box.
oh yeah, in total they're probably going to be able to accommodate about 200.
Wow. Are you built these? Do you have to build them if you're interested as a listener? And I'm thinking, well, okay, I could provide a home for bats in my yard. Is it something you need to build, or can you go to a store and buy them?
You could buy them, but it would be really good to make them because then you can use higher quality materials, and it would be cheaper to make them in some cases. Especially.
And Chris, I mean, if you're building a box or you're providing a home for bats on willingly, you are attracting, you're wanting to attract these bats to your area. What's to prevent them from rejecting the bat box but accepting your house?
So there isn't too much to stop them from doing that, but what I would say is that if you build bat boxes, it's good to have the bats around your yard. But if your house is vulnerable, if there's openings where they could possibly be infesting, then you definitely want to make sure that you have all that sealed up before you would undertake inviting the bats to your area. So it is the common.
And if you're inviting bats because you want to put up a bat box, or you have a dead tree in your yard, bats, I'm told, love dead trees, and you don't take that tree out, should you be talking to your neighbors about your desire to attract bats?
Definitely, I've dealt with many issues with neighbors from, ones being upset at each other to got them kind of banding together to try to resolve these issues on, as a group. A common issue that I run into, especially this time of year, is that I have a house that has bats and then a few neighbors that don't and want to avoid them from moving to their home once they're kicked out of the other house.
So you ethically remove them, which we're going to talk about, but you also say that bats are relatively harmless. For the most part, they are harmless. Is the only danger from these bats the fact that they're a nuisance if they're in your house and their droppings are building up in your attic walls or your attic floor and or being potentially bitten by one of these animals?
So I think one of the main worries for a bat that's just flying around outside, usually for people with long hair, that maybe it would swoop and get caught in their hair while it's chasing a bug and end up biting them. The actuality chance of that happening is very low. It doesn't happen very often. Now, rabies obviously is one of the main concerns when it comes to bats. And although that also is extremely rare to contract rabies from a bat, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Catherine, I believe it is the most common way for a human to contract rabies is from bat bite. So, that's the most common fear that I get from my customers, obviously, even if they're not in their living space and they're just in their attic or a wall, is rabies.
Catherine, I saw you nod about that being the most common way a human might contract rabies. What about pets? If the bat bites your pet, will they contract rabies if the bat has rabies?
They could if they're not up to date on their rabies vaccine. So you definitely want to, if you think your pet has had a possible exposure with bats or with any other wildlife that could carry rabies, a raccoon, a skunk, a fox, you want to talk to your veterinarian. I will say here in North Carolina, we test when we don't know if, a bat has rabies or not, and there was a human exposure. That bat will get sent off to a lab for testing. And luckily, it's only about 3% of the bats that get tested for rabies that come up positive with it. So we see much higher rabies prevalence in raccoons and foxes and skunks in our state. But like Chris was saying, when people get rabies, it's usually from a bat bite, and that's because it's such an insignificant bite that a lot of times people don't seek medical treatment for it. And so once those rabies symptoms show up, it typically means, the person's not going to make it. So a lot of times people are more likely to seek medical treatment for a bite from a larger animal because they're more concerned about that.
So Chris mentioned you have long hair, Catherine, and you go looking and conducting censuses of bats. And he mentioned people having this fear of bats getting tangled in your hair. Does that happen?
Never happened to me. You do hear it a lot, though. Especially from, a certain generation, I'll say. We'll see. People will tell me, one time a bat swooped near me. It was trying to make a nest in my hair. But one thing is bats don't make nests. They're not like a bird, which will, build a nest and collect nesting material and do that kind of thing. But what Chris mentioned is bats will swoop near you because they're trying to eat insects. So when we go out at night, insects are swarming around us. They're biting us, mosquitoes and other insects. And that's a buffet for bats. And so bats may get near you because they're trying to swoop and pick off those insects, but they don't want anything to do with you or your hair or anything like that. I've often joked if that was a way to catch bats, I would like tease my hair up as high as I possibly could and just stand outside and try to catch bats, because otherwise we have such a hard time catching bats. We spend the bulk of our summer staying up all night trying to catch bats. Difficult. Yeah.
Jacob, if you build a bat box, will they come? Is it like that old baseball adage from the movie long ago? Is it just because you build one and put it in the right place and at the right height? Because I think they're supposed to be 10 to 20 feet off the ground, right. And with the right exposure, etc. Does that necessarily mean that you will attract them?
There's a very good chance. If you do everything right, you try to set it up in the best way possible with the highest quality, making sure it's far enough away from vegetation. It's close to a water source, and it's suitable for the bats. Yeah, it should. But like I did, I built it a little bit out of season. So it may take a while and possibly next season. The timing can determine how long it's going to take for them to find it as well.
Because we have a question from Blake, who's a listener on Facebook. How long should it take for a bat to find the bat house? I had one of my on my house for about a year and no bats yet.
So, I guess you'd hope for the best, but if you build it during the right time during the season, it might just take 2 weeks, or it might just take a few months or a year. I mean, it's really up in the air.
So, Chris, because bats are federally protected as an endangered species, it is against the law to harm a bat or even a bat roost, even if they're in your home or place of business, which is why people have to call people like you. This is where you come in, and you're in the business of responsibly removing and remediating the spaces that they occupied. When you extricate bats from buildings, how do you do it in an ethical manner?
So the typical process for removing bats from a residential home is what we would call an exclusion. So we're locating, firstly, where the bats are entering and roosting, and then secondly, where are possible areas where they might move next if those areas are closed off? So those could include areas like soffit eaves and shelves and ends on your home. Like I was saying before, the louvers, the gable peak vents, also the ridge capping on the top of your home, which runs across the peaks, and just anywhere really where there's a gap, your thumb or so large, and it's high enough up where they're going to want to go into it, which tends to be 15 to 25 feet up. So we're sealing up all the areas where they might go, and then we're setting up what's called an exclusion device or a valve or a one-way funnel in the area where they're currently entering and exiting from. It's tapered off to the bottom, wider at the top. It goes over the area where they're directly entering, and then when they go to leave, as the sun goes down, they're all forced to squeeze out the end of that funnel, and once they try to come back in when the sun's coming up, they're not able to re-enter into that area, and they're going to start looking for a new area to enter. As long as we've closed all those potential areas off, they're going to likely move on to your neighbor's home.
And pup season of mating, I guess the birthing season, is spring and fall, I understand. And bats cannot be removed at that time of year.
Between May 1st and August 1st is a blackout for us. So anyone in North Carolina who has bats during that time They're typically going to be waiting till August 1st or that first week of August or so until we can actually start to remove the bats. Sometimes we may start to do the work to prevent them from jumping to new areas in the meantime. And then we would come back in the beginning of August and set up our removal devices, wait a few days, come back, make sure they're all out, and then start to look at what we need to do to remediate any feces and urine and doing cleanup.
So, Catherine, one of the dangers that are facing these bats, in addition to the white nose fungus that's really decimating their populations, is the disappearance of natural habitat. And we've talked about that a lot because Charlotte is becoming a city. The city of trees is losing a lot of it, of its trees and its natural habitat. Where do females go to have their pups and raise them in the early stages of life if they don't have access to houses or bat boxes or dead trees or places like, we don't have a lot of caves in this area. Where do they go?
Yeah, so they can use other artificial structures. Certain species will not. And some of those can be like under bridges or in culverts under roadways. It's not the majority of culverts and bridges. We have to really look. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. But when we find bats using bridges and culverts, they're usually pretty faithful to those structures. And so we can monitor them over time. Also, the Charlotte area has a neat history in terms of gold mining. There was a prominent gold rush in the 1800s in the Charlotte area and surrounding Piedmont area. And many of those former abandoned gold mines are still on the landscape. They're just holes in the ground. And like you said, we don't have a lot of caves in this area. And so bats will actually hibernate in those old gold mines. And even the tricolored bat, which is one of our rarest bats that we've talked about today, that's the primary species that we see hibernating in these gold mines. So now they're kind of like our gold that we find in there instead of actual gold.
So bats, as we all know, roost upside down. They hang upside down. I'm not sure why they do that, but that's what they do. And I read yesterday that they give birth upside down and that the mother has to catch the pup before it falls to the ground. That seems challenging. Let's put it that way. How big are they when they're born?
Yeah, they're like a third of the mother's body weight. So they're pretty big compared to the mom. But bats in general in our area are very small. Like the tricolored bat weighs what a nickel weighs. So 4 to 5 grams. For the mom, a third of her weight is huge.
And she has to take care of them until they can fly. How long is that?
Yeah, so it can vary depending on the species. So anywhere from like 3 to 6 weeks.
Wow. Are we working on the disappearance of natural habitat or is that a lost cause?
Yeah, there's a lot of different avenues to come at bat conservation. So one of them is, you know, directly working with white nose syndrome, thinking about treatments. And another way is to actually support surviving bats. And one of those includes habitat loss and trying to mitigate habitat loss, provide habitat where we can, protect other habitat from becoming lost. And so there's a lot of room to do anything we can for these survivors of white nose syndrome.
And Jacob, that's what your bat boxes do. You're giving them more options in which to live and have their pups, etc. I read that some of these bat boxes are single chambers, some are multiple chamber bat boxes. Why the difference? Why isn't it just a box hanging up high?
Well, multi-chamber bat box is generally going to hold more bats. I use single chamber for my design, and that's pretty much because we were already going to do 4 of them, so that's already going to hold about 200 bats. And if we did a multi-chamber, that would have made us gone a lot over budget for what we could do. multi-chamber, it is a good option. And so is single chamber, but multi-chamber is typically going to get you more bats.
Carol on Facebook writes, we've been hosting bats for decades. We have a luxury house made by Bat B&B. We have a very small group of 5 bats presently. We've had as many as 60. The new deluxe box can house 300. Catherine, wow. Do you want 300 bats around your house?
I just yes, absolutely, you do. Absolutely.
Catherine Etchison is a wildlife diversity biologist with North Carolina Wildlife Commission. Chris Shomo is the guy you call if you got a problem, a wildlife specialist and wildlife damage control agent with A1 Wildlife Control. And Jacob Schmidt, I'm assuming you got your Eagle Scout badge for building bat boxes. He's a rising sophomore at Northwest Cabarrus.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.